Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is SongTrader founder and CEO, Paul Wiltshire. First of all, there's a sad news item this week, and that's the passing of Prince. Prince was incredibly influential, mostly because what he did is he took different genres and he successfully melded them together, pretty much in a way that nobody else did. He took funk and he took some rock and pop as well, and he got it all together. And not too many artists are able to do that, especially in the way he did it. I didn't work with Prince, but I did have one brief connection with him. This was in the 80s at Sunset Sound. Sunset Sound is a very famous studio on Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood. And Prince really liked the place. And before he built Paisley Park, that's where he recorded many of his albums. Well, I happened to be working there in one of the studios. And we were on a break and we were outside. And I noticed Prince was shooting baskets because the studio had a basketball court. And I thought, well, I'll go shoot some baskets with them. I feel like shooting some. And as I walked over and about to open up the gate, out of nowhere came this huge man. He stood in front of me, folded his arms and said, "Prince don't want no company." I thought, okay, I guess I'm not shooting baskets with Prince. And really the whole time I was there, which is for maybe 10 days, that was the only time I saw him. And he was there for most of that same period. Anyway, the reason why I bring up Prince today is because of his business acumen, which was very unique and something that not many people are aware of. First of all, he sold a lot of records, but not as many as you might think. And especially from 1992 on, he only sold 16, 17 million records in the last 25 years. That's a lot of records, yes. It's a lot of units. But by superstar standards, it isn't at all. Now, he sold more prior to that. But once he hit 1992, and the reason why I say 1992 is that's when SoundScan started to be used to really track the sales accurately. Before that, there was no accurate way to track sales. But this used the barcode on a record or a CD. So every time someone bought something, it was scanned. And that's what SoundScan used for their information. So it was fairly accurate. Well, he didn't sell as many as you would think. But again, there's a lot of artists. David Bowie was the same way, but incredibly influential, and influential in cultural ways, in music ways, of course, we all take that for granted, fashion, a lot of different things. Prince was really on top of his game. But the one thing that people don't realize is when Prince changed his name to that symbol and became the artist formerly known as Prince, there was a good business reason for that. And what happened was he was in a big dispute with Warner Brothers, his record label at the time. And it was a dispute over money and it was a dispute over music. And he found out he could not get out of the contract. So he thought that what he would do is he would either sit it out, he wouldn't record at all, and then discovered that the trademark, his name, Prince, was controlled by Warner Brothers. So at that point, they could repackage albums, put it out as new. They could take outtakes, put it out as new. And this happens all the time with artists and bands. And of course, he didn't want that. And the only way that he could really fight back, and it's brilliant because what he did is he changed his name to the symbol. And since everybody knew about it, they knew if there was a new album under the Prince moniker, that it probably wasn't new material. It wasn't from the artist formerly known, or as most in the industry called him, the artist. So that was kind of brilliant. One of the things that he really wanted was he wanted his masters back. And Warner Brothers, of course, said no. And of course, that was another big point in the dispute. Another thing that happened was he signed this big contract in 1993 or 1994, but it had a clause in it that basically said if he didn't sell 5 million, he wasn't going to get an advance, or he was going to get a very small one rather than $10 million an album, which is what the press heard about. And at the time, he wasn't selling. As a matter of fact, there were several albums that he did that didn't even go gold. They sold 700,000-800,000, so he didn't get an advance. And of course, he was upset about that. So there was a lot of reasons for him to change his name and then put out albums under that particular moniker. Before he could do that, though, he had to fulfill his contract. So what he did is he took outtakes. He took songs that were never intended to be released, and he put them on four or five crap albums just so he could burn through the rest of his contract and then record on his own. So the interesting part comes after that. So here we are, 2001 or so, and Prince becomes really the first indie artist. He starts his own record label, and he doesn't even have distribution. What he does is he actually starts an online store. This is in 2001. This is before it became hip. So he's way ahead of his time with this. Then, on top of it, what he ends up doing is he's going to be playing this huge series of shows in the UK, 21 nights, I believe. So he does this special with The Mail, the Sunday newspaper in London, where everyone gets a free CD with the newspaper. So that was 2 million copies of the CD. Brilliant. And of course, what that does, it makes him platinum right away. First platinum record since he went on his own. And then he turns around, he does another thing. Then he gives a free CD away to everybody that buys a ticket to his concerts. So before you know it, his sales look like they're gangbusters, even though he's giving the stuff away. And as a result, the RIAA turned around and said, okay, no more of that. So that's why you haven't seen anything like that since then, but it was very innovative at the time. So Prince finally ended up getting his copyrights back from Warner Brothers. It took until 2014 till he actually did a deal with them. And he turned around and he licensed them back. He was the owner at that point, but he does a deal, another one, with Warner Brothers for his back catalog. And then his new album that just came out, very much like David Bowie, album coming out just as he dies. He did a deal with Columbia on that. Again, here he is. He's acting as an indie. And what may be the most famous, influential indie artist ever. And he's pulling it off. So pretty interesting. The other thing that he did that was very, very modern of him, it wasn't that long ago when Prince actually pulled his music off of all of the online distribution platforms, Apple Music, Spotify, Pandora, everything. He pulled it all off and he put it on one place, Tidal. So now what you're seeing with Tidal is that's the only place that you can hear Prince online, except if you go, of course, to YouTube, and YouTube, you're watching illegal uploads, user-generated uploads. Of course, Prince also was very litigious. He went through a series of lawsuits with people for using his music on Facebook, on YouTube. And many times what ended up happening, it was really bad publicity for him and he would pull lawsuits. But he was really on top of protecting his copyrights, much more so than many, many other artists. He was a smart guy on a lot of different levels and he doesn't get enough credit for being an innovator in the music business side. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program, as well as some of my other online video courses. Go to bobbyosinskicourses.com to learn more. Okay, one more brief item. Record Store Day just passed this last week, and this was a big deal for a long time, for about the last 10 years, actually since 2008, 9 years, I guess, and has been credited with revitalizing the vinyl industry. Because what would end up happening was there were new releases that would happen every record store day, and a lot of artists would go to indie record stores, the mom and pop stores, brick and mortar places, and would promo their work on vinyl. And that really was a great shot in the arm for the industry. That being said, now there's a big backlash. The reason why is, if you're a record store that wants to participate in it, now you have to play by some rules. And the rules basically are you have to buy this brand new vinyl from the major record labels and the big indies. You have to stock it. And guess what? You can't return it if it doesn't sell. So a lot of these small indie stores are saying, wait a second, the major labels have co-opted Record Store Day and they're not participating any longer. This is actually a very bad turn. It's the last thing anybody expected, but now they're very upset the fact that they can't participate anymore because it costs them a lot of dough. The other thing that's happening is a lot of artists are saying, oh, forget this. And the reason why is they can't get their vinyl in the store fast enough because the major record labels have taken up all the capacity of the record manufacturing plants. So what they're saying is, if we can't get our records in the store to promote, then there's no sense in us promoting. So this has become a very bad precedent. It's the last thing anybody expected. But in fact, I think we're going to see more of this in the coming years. So you might have seen the last best Record Store Day, unfortunately. My guest today is Paul Wilshire, who's the founder and CEO of SongTrader. Paul's an award-winning producer and songwriter in his native Australia, and he gained some international fame with some big hits with the Backstreet Boys. He started SongTrader to help music supervisors, film directors, and brands more easily license music from artists and bands. I spoke with Paul from his office in Los Angeles. Let's start from the top. Tell me about SongTrader. What's the idea behind it?
SongTrader is two things. It's a content management system for creators and owners of music rights connected to a marketplace where any music rights buyers, whether they be licensing for TV, film, advertising or other opportunities, but also it's also a marketplace for rights acquisition. So it's an area where investors or labels or music entrepreneurs, publishers can also acquire rights.
Investors, that's an interesting aspect. I never considered that when looking at your website.
Well, it's not something we focus on. I see the music industry as to some degree shut off from outside investment because rights and music rights, because of their fragmented nature, it's hard to access, hard to understand. So we see that, well, music rights are a commodity and such, and they are something that, and this is not, it's probably not where I should be focusing our conversation because it's not our focus. Our focus is on solving the transaction process for licensing and providing a platform that empowers creators and labels and publishers, but it does open the gate to outside investment. And if we look at the trend we see with crowdfunded and crowd-supported artists that have emerged over the last few years, it's really taking that to another level where investors would potentially have the ability to invest in rights and use the platform to exploit those rights or go off platform to find ways to benefit from those rights. And we're very, very careful to make sure that our users understand their rights, and we want to provide them with the ability to completely control their rights so that they come onto our platform. It's a non-exclusive relationship. They have complete control over how they price their music. We have spent an extensive amount of time developing a comprehensive licensing pricing model, which allows our users to select what is a preset that sort of best describes who they are and what they are, and to price their music conservative or aggressively. And that automatically populates pricing based on what the proposed uses in a licensing arena.
Is that what you call variable pricing?
Yes, yes.
So how does that work then? I couldn't quite get my arms around it when I was looking at it, but I didn't.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So what we've done is we engaged the services of a number of clearance experts who'd worked at many of the major companies in the past, and record companies and publishers. And we built a model that basically works on multipliers. So there's so many different license types, like there's so many different variables under each license type. So just looking at normal sync licensing and the different media type series, whether it's a TV promo, trailer, TV drama, film, advertising, video game, or something online. We developed this platform so that you really just choose a preset that best describes where you're at. You might be an emerging songwriter or a professional songwriter. You might be a buzz artist or an established artist or a label or a publisher. So once you choose that preset, that works as one variable trigger. And then you choose either to price your catalog or song by song, either low or high. It's just a slider that you position. And underneath that, while you're positioning that slider, you'll see automatically a number of example prices populate so that you can see what you'll get for a film, but subject to certain criteria, such as whether the film is a $25 million plus budget, the term is perpetuity, the territory is the world, etc. But you'll also see examples in TV, TV promo, trailer, video game, etc. So then you can see, and they'll all be different prices based on those two settings, where you put the slider from low to high and the preset that describes you.
That's a pretty cool idea, actually.
Cool. Thank you. Well, it sort of works. It works very intuitively from both sides. So if I'm a buyer and I search on the platform and I enter that criteria, so I might be, for example, looking to license a piece of music for film, but it's an independent film. I'm only going to exploit it online and say at festivals. It will then price the music accordingly. So you would expect a piece of music to be a lot cheaper for that kind of license than potentially a $25 million plus feature film. And so we wanted to create an environment where we have an automated system, so we're not bogged down, both the seller and the buyer aren't slowed down by trying to work out what the right price is, by capitalizing on other people's experience in the past, on industry trends, historic data. We're able to create a system where buyers and sellers can easily transact without the need for all of the additional lawyers that can be involved and all of the complications that can often slow down the process.
It's taking the negotiation out of the process, basically, right?
It is, and to a degree, because we also allow the user to not set the price. They can just say, well, I want to research every opportunity before anything happens. So we have the option for our sellers to say offers only. And what that means is that if there is a buyer on the platform that's interested in using a piece of music for a particular project and the seller has set it to offers only, then they will have to submit to the seller exactly what they're using the music for. They have to describe what sort of media it is, what sort of production, a creative, so that the seller can be completely informed when making a decision and providing a quote. And there's counter offer opportunity. So that we do allow the opportunity for negotiation to also coexist on the platform.
This is a great idea, and I can understand why songwriters and publishers would get involved with this, and it's probably very easy to get them to sign on. But of course, that's only one part of the equation, and you have to have buyers on the other side. So how are you going about getting them? Because that's really the key. If you have buyers, then the sellers are going to be happy.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And we launched our beta version in May last year, and we spent right up until the end of February this year completely focused in terms of our efforts and what little advertising we did through that year on attracting catalogs, labels, and independent artists, songwriters, composers, so that there was an exciting amount of content on the platform, so that buyers would be able to have the right journey. And we are now in a position where we've got so much curated content so that buyers can either come to the platform and discover music via our curated playlists, or they can search on keywords and genres and titles and lyrics and all kinds of methods. So we've just we literally came out of our beta version 2 weeks ago, and we've just commenced our advertising push towards obtaining buyers. We've got we have 4 full-time account executives, and I use that term lightly. They're really music supervisor clearance experts, and they come from music supervisor background. They're very creative. They all have fantastic ears, and they are all about searching through the platform, finding the right content to suit all of the opportunities that they're connected to. So individually and collectively, they have a number of connections in the trailer community, in the film community, TV community, and advertising communities. And they're on the phones, and they're out lunching and working very hard to bring opportunities each day to our users. We have to expand that over the year. We need more people. There has to be a strong human element, and we also have to work very hard on the online element. So we're bringing in buyers internationally as well.
Yeah, visibility is the key here, I guess. If enough buyers know about this, and there's enough music to their liking, then of course it's going to work. And I'm sure it is working, because you have a very slick site. It looks great. The idea is dynamite. I guess I'm curious, how did this all get started? Was this your idea mostly?
It was. My background, I've had the version that you see, I've had a lot of influence and help from the great team I have around me. But my background is a songwriter, producer, and predominantly I grew up in Australia and had a reasonably successful time as a producer and songwriter there. I produced and written for a number of household names in that country as well as over here. Bands like Backstreet Boys, I could reel off some Australian names that would be probably maybe less known to your audience, but there's Human Nature and Vanessa Amorosi and Delta Goodrum are a number of household Australian names. And the process as a songwriter, going through that journey, and also I started a small publishing boutique, publishing and record label back in Australia. I found the process very frustrating in terms of when opportunities came, in terms of license opportunities, that there might be, say, one party or there was one writer who needed legal advice something that would slow down the transaction process, and then the opportunity would just evaporate. And also being in a smaller country like that, accessing the United States, and I would say that we're probably looking at 60-70% of the entertainment business is here, possibly more. And the access for us down there was so difficult. So there was a number of problems that were swirling around my head before embarking on this. And one problem is that we needed to move to the US, which was a move that I made with my family. But the two issues that I think we solved, and I haven't spoken about, one of them is also connecting rights owners together. So, for example, if I write a song with you and I want to put it on SongTrader, I would upload that song and I would put in your details as, a co-writer. And SongTrader would send you an email if you're not a SongTrader member. And it would ask you it would seek your consent for that song to be listed on SongTrader. And as you go through the consent sign-up process, if you agree to the splits, and if I say that you wrote 50% and I wrote 50% and you agree with that, then the song will then appear in your catalog on SongTrader as well as my catalog on SongTrader. And any future license that occurs, any proceeds that we earn from a sale will immediately be credited to each of our accounts, subject to the ownership splits between us. So it was a way that we could collaborate with each other and sell something to buyers and make it feel like they were only transacting with one party. And if you imagine that in a more complicated sense, where there might be four writers, four different publishers, and a label involved.
Yeah, that's crazy.
The complexity of trying to settle that transaction, there's so much risk for that just falling over. So, you know, we have a long-term goal to really build a lot of the build on our catalog so that there's more and more people using that as a way of being able to simplify that process.
How large is the catalog now?
Well, we have an organic process where tracks are uploaded every day. We're well over 100,000 tracks.
Wow.
But we also have a lot more on our FTP coming in from larger catalogs. So just in the last 2 weeks, there's 40,000 tracks have come in. So I expect to see us, I anticipate we'll be closer to 2 to 3 million by the end of the year.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. Definitely. Okay. So how long was this journey then from when you first got the idea to when it finally came to fruition?
I think all up it must be close to 3 years now. You spend a lot of time conceptualizing and building prototypes, scrapping prototypes. And the one thing about, I think, technology and in particular music and how complex the way write flow is.
Yeah.
It's kind of like opening Pandora's box, you know, that you think you solve one thing and then you realize there's 10 other things to solve.
Yeah.
And it's choosing which things are the right things to solve in what order. That is the challenge. And I mean, with this so many, our development list is, it has pages and pages and pages, and we have to sort of focus, well, where are the demands and where do we focus on now? But all in all, the bulk of the journey has been in the last, really the last 2 years. And that's where the first year of that was purely development. The last year has been about populating the platform and this really our first official year is all about really getting results for our users.
Did you bootstrap it, or did you have investment?
A bit of both. Bootstrapped in the first instance, but there's been there is a number of investors in the company now. We've done several rounds, and I think that will continue to be the case for the short term if we're to aggressively expand.
Yeah, right. It's always the case, isn't it? You need money to get larger.
I mean, to reach all those markets. We're getting music from India and Russia and all kinds of places. So to properly serve all those markets, it definitely costs a lot. So we're likely to be spending a lot more on advertising in the coming years, and potentially going to be spending a lot more on staff. How accurate our data is, how intuitive our search is, all of that requires a lot of manpower.
Well, speaking of accuracy, do you check copyrights on uploads?
We listen to everything that comes in. So if anything's just obvious, if there's anything that's obvious that is an infringement, we'll pull it down. What we can't physically check the copyright ownership of everything until such a time, I think, where we have APIs talking seamlessly with PROs.
Yeah.
But at this stage, we have a comprehensive system after any transaction for checking registrations and ensuring that hasn't been an infringement. We have a violation reporting system if anyone feels their copyrights have been violated in any way. One of the biggest issues is actually, I think it happens through innocence, and it might be that someone uploads a piece of music, they're the writer, but they're unaware that they're not the master recording owner. They might have done it with a producer, and the producer provided their services on spec, or just never settled an arrangement. So it's almost like there is an agreement waiting to be settled. So we're developing a number of activities that we hope to educate better this area, and we'll be doing this online and through social media and through YouTube, and this will be something to expect this year. That we see the need to educate as much as possible. Just some guidance around the complexity of music rights, but make it simple. So what is a master recording? Who owns master recordings? How do you own master recordings? How does it even come to be? The difference between publishing and PRO registration, all of that information, we feel like we have a responsibility to educate and improve that process.
Well, what is the metadata that a writer or a publisher has to fill in? How extensive is that?
So for larger catalog owners, we tend to ingest it all at once. Most labels have reasonably good metadata. Certainly production music libraries have very strong metadata, and we can ingest that in one hit. But for a new user who's uploading songs and needs to fill out metadata for their track, it runs on a few levels. So they have to fill out all of the copyright owner, and that can include writers, publishers, administrators, fill out their PRO details. They have to also complete who the master owner is. But then it goes into, it's better to have a song description. It's better to add your lyrics, because often music supervisors are searching for a certain kind of lyrics to match the sound they're looking for. It's also, we have the normal things like moods, genres, tags, keywords. And then it goes into things like, there are a lot of optionals, and most of this is optional, where choosing tempos and other little bits and pieces like IRSC codes, ISWC codes, et cetera, et cetera. We go very deep, but it's an optional depth. And we do that purposely, because we really want to create a very clear ownership tree, so that the rights can be easily transacted, and not only that, be properly accounted for afterwards, so that buyers have all of the information they need to file proper cue sheets, etc. So we don't take any interest in any royalties. We only make money when our users do. We charge a transaction fee of 17.5% on any completed transaction, but we don't take any royalty stream afterwards. So it's we tried to build the platform and the business model to be really beneficial for our users, so that they have these great tools where they can create playlists and share their music. They can, they can be active or they can be passive in the platform, and ideally without any risk. So we only earn when they earn.
Yeah, that's very fair, actually. That sounds like a good way to do it. What happens if a co-writer doesn't register? Does everything just stop in its tracks then until that happens?
In the context where someone uploads a piece of music, connects to a co-writer, and the co-writer does nothing?
Yeah.
Because it's a content management system first and foremost, a user can upload any amount of content and choose to... and if that music doesn't connect to those people, meaning that a label, it might be a major label or something, says, no, we're not interested at this point, then what will happen is the music will remain in the system, but it won't be discoverable in the marketplace.
Ah, I see.
So the user will still have the benefit of being able to create his own playlist. So, for example, he or she might want to curate 10 tracks and put it together in a playlist and pitch it at an opportunity that they've come across. So they can still do that and use it as a tool to just benefit their own way of business. And I mean, we're not encouraging transactions to be done off platform, but at the same time, we're giving tools unconditionally to our users to use for their own benefit.
Who's your major customer? Who do you see using the platform the most?
Well, I think it's probably too early. I mean, talking purely from a buyer perspective, I think it's potentially too early to call that. But I really believe it's where we're putting a lot of energy is in solving, making it a simple process for advertisers. And we're certainly putting a lot of energy into connecting to creative teams around advertising agency groups. We see that as certainly a huge growth area that will continue to grow. If you look at the size of the advertising industry, and it's something like half a trillion or something. So it's continuing to grow, and so it makes sense for us to put a lot of energy into connecting our music makers to brands and advertisers. I think second to that. Absolutely, film, TV, and the trailer world. It's a very competitive space, and I think as our brand grows, so will our connectivity. So it's there's also the emerging online media, and you know that's a place that we're certainly focused on as well as you know serving the long tail, the smaller transactions. So you might be someone coming along just wanting to do license a piece of music for their independent film or documentary. There's definitely a growing market there as do-it-yourself filmmaking becomes a lot easier and a lot more achievable with the tools they have now. And looking at that as a global arena and giving them access to great curated content is important. The filmmaker in Bulgaria has access to get some good music. He doesn't have to. He can look outside his locality.
Yeah, as I'm talking to you, I'm thinking to myself that really right now everything kind of revolves on price. But if it's price and convenience as you're offering, that adds another level to purchasing music that wasn't there before. Because if you can do it and do it quickly and not have to involve business affairs. That's a big plus for you guys, definitely. Well, for everybody, really.
Yeah, we hope so. We certainly hope so. My lawyer friends might disagree.
Yeah, right. All right, here's a big picture question for you. Where do you see the music business going from your perspective and what you're doing? And I know that you're trying to make everything easy, and you definitely are making things easier from where you sit. But just stepping back for a second and looking at the entire music business, where do you see it going in the next few years?
It's a tough question to say as an overall, because I think it's being shaped pretty clearly now where there's always going to be the super artists, the super brands, and they sort of have their own, they live in their own world. And the 99% other creators and artists, I think that's where the shift is probably going to be the greatest, and it's through empowerment, through utility, that the access to the online community and how they access that and how they utilize social media and the rest of it is really where the change is. Would I predict that the market share will shift more to that? I would say it's very possible. I certainly think from a B2B point of view, it will. I think because there's more and more content being created, the need for competitive pricing is going to be more and more paramount. And I think the more choice and the more access creates, I guess, a more transparent marketplace that will see potentially more independent bands, more independent artists accessing placements with major advertisers, with major film, because often their music is equally great, And it's just that they don't have that huge marketing spend that's put that really puts the division in the two. I'm always reluctant to try and predict scenarios. I'm very, very focused on our world, and I'm confident where we're going.
Okay. That's fair enough. So in this journey from being a songwriter, producer, to being a tech CEO, I'm sure that you've learned a whole lot and things that you probably never thought you'd learn. So last question for you, what's the best piece of business advice that you learned along the way, or maybe someone imparted to you?
I think that what's the best business? I would say to be very careful to not to act out of ego and pride, and to always look at all of the information that you're receiving through your staff, through your friend, through your colleagues, through your family, and really take in all of the information. Be it, study, but I think so many mistakes are made in business through ego, and I've certainly been guilty of it myself. And it's having that balance of and incorporating into that balance, I think one of the tricks to potentially a good life is being very conscious of your health, being conscious of your daily routine, and not getting sort of driven by fear or driven by thinking that you must act a certain way because everyone's saying you should, and not going with what your instincts are and what your intuition is saying. So I guess to sum it up, to not act out of ego, and to listen to your intuition, and to research. That would be the three things.
That's great advice, Paul. Definitely. Good luck with the platform. Thank you for being with me today. I'm sure the platform is going to be very successful. SongTrader just, it looks dynamite, and it just feels right. It feels good. It feels like it's the right place at the right time. So good luck with it.
Great. Thank you so much, Bobby. I really appreciate the time, and all the best. Thank you.
To find out more about Paul and SongTrader, go to songtrader.com. That's SongTrader. There's no E there. SongTrader, SongTrader. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. He's the reason the show is on the air, because he's the guy that first said you should have your own podcast. Many, many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and most recently, Google Play. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.